listening to the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network, broadcasting on satellite GE1, transponder 7, 7.56 audio, and over 700 FM stations across the nation and around the world. The hour of the time is also carried on WRMI, Worldwide Shortwave Radio, 9955 kilohertz, Monday through Friday nights, 5 until 7 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time.
This is my daddy's station. I'm Pooh, classic radio like you always wished it could be. 101.1 FM, Eager.
101.1 FM is owned and operated by the Independence Foundation Trust as a non-profit community service.
You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Ladies and gentlemen, this week, this Saturday and Sunday, April 26th and 27th, I will be speaking in Porterville, California. The fee is $10 per person. Saturday, April 26th, 1997, from 1 until 7 p.m., and Sunday from 1 until whenever. Again, $10 per person. For more information, call Doyle Shamley at 209-781-0374. That's 209-781-0374. An awful lot of people have already paid for their seats. I suggest that if you want to attend, that you call that number and make arrangements to make sure that you have a reserved seat. Otherwise, you may show up at the door and find that there is no place for you. And we certainly don't want that to happen. And that's really the reason why we extended it to Sunday also, because so many people want to come to this event that there just isn't room for everybody on Saturday. And so we'll have an extra session on Sunday. But make sure you call the number, because the response has just been absolutely overwhelming. In fact, let me give you that number again for those of you who want to attend. It is Saturday, April 26th and Sunday, April 27th, 1997, from 1 until 7 p.m. on Saturday and from 1 until whenever on Sunday. It's $10 per person. For more information, call Doyle Shamley at 209-781-0374. That's 209-781-0374. Porterville is approximately 50 miles northeast of Bakersfield, California, for those of you who may not know where that is at. Let me see here. Also, take note of the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network programming. And by the way, we made OnSat now. OnSat magazine has taken notice of the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network, and there was a little blurb about us in there in the last issue. Worldwide Freedom Radio Network programming all times are Eastern Daylight Time, Monday through Friday, 5 until 7 p.m., the hour of the time with William Cooper, yours truly. Monday and Tuesday nights, 9 until 10 p.m., Quest for Health with Michael Cottingham. Thursdays, 9 to 11 p.m., Home Satellite Radio Show with Dan Morgan. And Fridays, 9 to 11 p.m., Friday Night Live with Gary Bourgeois. Saturdays, 11 p.m. until 1 a.m., American Exposé with Chris Gerner. And this Sunday, there will be no additional programming at the normal time at noon. It will not occur simply because I'm not going to be here. And everything here is going to be on running on ACO, with Connie standing by to fix any problems that may unexpectedly arise. Also, Thursday and Friday and Monday and Tuesday will be reruns. They'll be good reruns, so don't miss the hour of the time just because they'll be reruns. They'll be the best reruns that we can find in our extensive catalog of tapes. Now, spread the word, folks, and if you can possibly attend any of these showings of Waco, the Rules of Engagement, please do so. It'll be showing at the following locations on the following days. The USA Film Festival, AMC Glen Lakes Theater, 9450 North Central Expressway, Dallas, Texas. The number is 214-855-6286. It will be showing Monday, that's today, at 7:15 p.m., and that's Eastern Daylight Time. That's today, 7:15 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time at the USA Film Festival, AMC Glen Lakes Theater, 2450 North Central Expressway, Dallas, Texas. The number is 214-855-6286. It will be showing Friday, May 2nd through Thursday, May 8th, 1997. At the Dolby Theater, that's D-O-B-I-E, the Dolby Theater, 2021, Guadalupe, Austin, Texas, 512-505-0105. Again, that's Friday, May 2nd through Thursday, May 8th, 1997, at the Dolby Theater, 2021, Guadalupe, Austin, Texas, 512-505-0105. We'll also be showing Sunday, June 1st, 1997. That's Sunday, June 1st, 1997, at the Atlanta Film Festival. The Atlanta Film Festival at the AMC 5th, spelled P-H-I-F-T-H, the AMC 5th, P-H-I-F-T-H, 14. That's the AMC 5th 14 across from the Lenox Shopping Center. That's across from the Lenox Shopping Center, 3500 Peachtree Road, Atlanta, Georgia. Connie, would you check on that name for me? This P-H-I-F-T-H doesn't sound right to me. It's the Atlanta Film Festival, AMC, and we've got written down here P-H-I-F, as in Fox, TH-14, the AMC 5th 14 across from the Lenox Shopping Center, 3500 Peachtree Road, Atlanta, Georgia, and that's Sunday, June 1st, 1997. It will be showing at the Sebastopol Cinemas, 6868 McKinley Street, Sebastopol, California, 95472. And the telephone number is 707-829-3921. That's 707-829-3921. And that showing begins Saturday, April 26, 1997. I don't know how long it's going to run, but probably longer than just that one day. That's in Sebastopol, California. It will also be showing at the Coolidge Center in Boston, Massachusetts, Friday, June 27th, 1997. I don't have an address or phone number for that theater. We'll also be at the Human Rights Watch Film Festival. We don't know the location of that yet, from Friday, June 6th through Sunday, June 8th. So there you have it. If you can possibly attend any of those, please do so. Connie, have you checked on that name for me? It's the Phipps. That's what I thought. I didn't think that sounded right. It's the AMC Phipps, spelled P-H-I-P-P-S 14. AMC Phipps 14, across from the Lenox Shopping Center, 3500 Peachtree Road, Atlanta, Georgia, showing Sunday, June 1st, 1997. And all times are correct for their own location. In other words, they're not Eastern, Central, or anything like that. Times I gave you are for the location where the film is being shown. Okay, Friday, I told you that our conference is scheduled, and we need you to sign up as quickly as you can, because there's not going to be a whole lot of room for a whole lot of people. We have limited number of positions available, and I'm going to give you member prices, and then I'll give you non-member prices. And no, you cannot hurry up and join to get the non-member prices. If you didn't think enough of our organizations to join beforehand, then I really don't care that you have to pay some extra money if you want to attend our conference. That's what I think about it. So, and I don't care whether you like it or not. The conference will be held in the state of Arizona. The location will only be given to those who have paid and reserved their spot. Now, make sure you understand this. Once you have paid, it is non-refundable. If you all of a sudden cannot attend, you must arrange for somebody else to pay you and attend in your place. Otherwise, you lose that money. You see, we have to reserve the whole installation where we're going to have this. So once it's paid for, it's paid for. I don't get a refund, and neither do you. And I'm not talking about me. I'm talking about the trust. We don't get refunds on this, folks. We have to pay for the whole facility, and there's reasons why. This time, this year, we have we have arranged with an absolutely fantastic facility. And this time, the conference price includes, for some people, a bed and all meals. A bed and all meals. For other people, conference and meals. Everybody who attends the conference must take their meals at the facility. And it's part of the price. And if you don't want to do this, then you're still going to have to pay for the meals, but you can go somewhere else and eat if you want to. But in order to get this fantastic facility, and you'll understand why once you've paid, and we let you know where it's going to be and send you all the information and everything, you'll be absolutely thrilled with it, I guarantee you. It's going to be 5 days from June 30th through July 4th, inclusive. And the last night, of course, we'll have a cookout and a big bonfire and all that kind of stuff like we always do. And talk into the wee hours are for some people, as they are wont to do, all night long. Because the last night, you've spent all week making such wonderful friends and relationships. And you've learned such a plethora of knowledge that you've never known before. That the last night everybody sits up and wants to just drag it out as long as they can, knowing that everybody has to leave the next day. So here are the member prices. Now this is for bed, meals, and conference. Now there are only 40 slots for this particular deal here. We only have 40 slots for meals, bed, and conference. Okay? For a single person, $400 total. That's meals, bed, and conference. For all 5 days, including the last night's camp out, and that includes all your food and everything. The only thing you have to bring is a blanket. Sheeting is provided. All you have to do is bring a blanket and a pillow if you want one. Okay? And so it's $400 for a single person. That includes meals, bed, and conference. For a couple, that's two people, meals, bed, and conference. And it's two beds, folks. Everybody's got a separate bed. For a couple, meals, bed, and conference. That's all meals, breakfast, lunch, and supper, all through. For a couple, $740 total. $740 total. Now, if you're going to bring children, for each, and you have meals, bed, and conference, and you want a bed for your child, for each child under 12, add $220. For each child over 12, add $270. So here it is. For meals, bed, and conference, one price for the whole bit. For a single person, it's $400. For a couple, $740. If you're going to bring a child, for each child under 12, add $220. For each child over 12, add $270. Now, that's for people who are going to attend and want all meals, want a bed at the location, and attend the conference, and it is a fantastic facility. You're going to love it. Now, for people who want to either get a motel or a hotel somewhere else in the immediate vicinity, and there are lots of them, folks, there's lots of them, this is the price. It includes meals and conference. Now, there are camping facilities at the conference location. So if you want to camp, bring all your camping gear, and you can camp right there, but you have to pay for the meals, and you have to take the meals with the group, breakfast, lunch, and supper, no matter where you stay, okay? So for a single person, meals and conference, and you can either make arrangements to stay at one of the local motels or hotels, or you may camp at the facilities. And for a single person, includes all meals, that's breakfast, lunch, and supper every day, and the conference, it's $340 total. For a couple, all meals and the conference, you can either camp at the facilities in beautiful campgrounds, or you can, of course, stay at any one of the local motels or hotels in the area. For a couple, all meals and the conference, $680. That's $680. Now, if you're not staying at the facility, all children under 5 are free. In other words, they don't even have to pay for their meals. All children under 5 are free if you're not staying at the facility. That includes if you're camping. Children under 12, if you're either camping or staying at a local motel, children under 12 add $120 apiece. That's for their meals. Children over 12 add $240 each. That's for their meals and the conference. We expect children over 12 will be probably attending the conference. Okay, that's it. Now, if you have questions or you didn't write all this down and you need to know something, call Connie. Call my secretary. You can call her during this broadcast if you wish. But these slots are going to go fast, ladies and gentlemen. They're going to go real fast. And if past experience tells us anything, they'll probably be gone in a very short period of time. So, we need you to send your fee in immediately, including all payments for all people who are going to attend. If you want meals, bed, and conference, make sure you get that in quick, because those will probably go the fastest. If you want to camp or you want to stay at a local motel, when you send your money in, we will send you a complete information pack, which will include the name, address, and phone number of all the local motels and hotels. And don't forget, if you're going to camp, you've got to bring all your camping equipment with you in order for you to be comfortable. Include sleeping bag. If you want to bring a tent, you can bring a tent, whatever you want to bring. If you're going to be in the meals, bed, conference deal, including a bed, sheeting is provided. All the rooms are heated, so you're not going to get cold at night. But if you want to bring a blanket and a pillow, you must furnish your own, okay? And that's just part of the deal. There is one cabin, ladies and gentlemen, beautiful cabin. The cabin has a kitchen and all of that good stuff. So if you want to stay in the cabin, then there's only one deal for the cabin, and that's double occupancy, so the price is for a couple. And that's $1,075 for all 5 days. That's the cabin. Give you complete privacy. It's got a kitchen. But this includes all the meals at the conference. Remember, everybody who attends must take meals with the group. If you're staying in the cabin, each child under 12, add $125. Each child over 12, add $245. And if you're not going to take your meals with the group and you're renting the cabin, if you're taking the cabin, just deduct $140 per person over 12 and deduct $70 per person under 12. And that will and that means per person. So if it's a couple, that means you got to for both. Okay, here are the non-member prices, folks. Non-member. And there are no deals, and there are no exceptions. If you're a non-member, you're a non-member. That's it. If you're not a member of CAGI or CAGI News Service, if you're not a member of the Intelligence Service, you are a non-member. And no, you cannot join immediately so that you can get the non-member, so that you can get the member prices. I'm not playing that game anymore. If you didn't think enough of our organizations to join it before this, then I really don't care that you have to pay all this extra money. For non-members, meals, bed, and conference, single person, $800. For a couple, $1,540. Again, meals, bed, and conference, for a single person, $800. For a couple, $1,540. For each child under 12, add $320. For each child over 12, add $370. If you're just going to attend the meals and the conference and you are a single person, it's $740 if you're a non-member. And if you're a couple, it's $1,480, non-members. Children under 5 are free. Children under 12 add $220. Children over 12 add $340. And again, that's just for the meals and the conference. You can either camp out in the grounds or you can rent a motel, hotel somewhere in the area. Now, if you didn't get all this, if it wasn't clear to you, or if you want some explanation, or if you want to jaw about it on the telephone and make sure that you've got it all right, call Connie at 520-333-4578. You can do it during this broadcast or any time after, up until 5 o'clock our time, and during normal business hours between 9 and 5 every day, the rest of this week or any other week for that matter, at 520-333-4578. Ladies and gentlemen, I forgot to tell you, if you plan on attending the annual conference, you need to make all checks or money orders payable to the Harvest Trust, which is handling this whole thing. The Harvest Trust. And send it to the Harvest Trust, P.O. Box 1970, that's 1970, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, Arizona 85925. Once again, make your checks or money orders payable to the Harvest Trust and send them to the Harvest Trust, P.O. Box 1970, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, Arizona 85925. And folks, if you want the cabin, you better send your money overnight, because that's going to go like immediately. Whoever wants it, whoever check we get first is going to get the cabin. And if you send in for the cabin and it's already gone, please give us instructions about what your next choice is, and we can refund the difference to you. Okay? Well, now I'm going to read to you a review. because a lot of people don't seem to think that I'm telling you the truth about Waco, the rules of engagement, this movie I've been telling you about. And this is a review, a movie review written by Ross Davidson, R-O-S Davidson, D-A-V-I-D-S-O-N. He's a syndicated columnist, and this appears in a lot of newspapers all over the place. And it doesn't matter if you read this review or the one that appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle or any of the other reviews that have been written on this movie all across the country. They all say the same thing. And so, U.S. government lied and lied again is the headline. The U.S. government lied and lied again is the headline. Now, this is not me talking. This is a movie review. A movie review written by Ross Davidson. He says, a disturbing new documentary suggests that the first ATF raid on the Branch Davidian compound was a publicity stunt that went terribly wrong, and the FBI's raid was a blatant act of revenge. April 19th has become one of the most feared dates on the American calendar. Special security precautions are thrown up around government buildings, and federal law enforcement agents look nervously over their shoulders. For America's burgeoning radical right, it is a date that will live in infamy. The bloody attack on the Branch Davidian compound in Waco, Texas, is, for them, proof positive that the government is their sworn enemy. They have sworn revenge. Now, just as an aside here, that first paragraph seems to be obligatory to all of these liberal writers. They have to say these things, or they can't maintain their status as a liberal journalist for some reason. And most of it's a lie. For anybody who considers themselves to be right-wing or a conservative American, what happened in Waco, Texas was a terrible, terrible travesty of justice and proof of tyranny in this country. There's no doubt about that. But it's not the government that's our sworn enemy, ladies and gentlemen. You see, we're loyal to the government, which is the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and all the lawful amendments thereto. However, our government's been infiltrated. What we are against are the criminals, the traitors, and the tyrants who have infiltrated our government and are trying to destroy it and bring about their socialist view of a utopian world government. That's who we're against. And we have not sworn revenge. None of us have sworn revenge, folks. That's an absolute total lie. And we have sworn that it will never happen again. That I can tell you for a fact. If the government or anybody in the government ever tries to pull off another Waco, Texas, they're going to find themselves at war. It's as simple as that. We will not allow it to happen. Let me continue now, because this is where he quits being the obligatory liberal socialist journalist who has to say those things and starts telling you the truth. You see, because we were right all along about what happened in Waco, Texas, and all of the tremendous criticism and derision and demonizing that was heaped upon us for telling the truth about what happened in Waco, Texas, is now becoming apparent even to the liberal socialists and to the journalists and to the Marxists and the communists, everybody. And it's them, mainly, who are flocking to see this film. We already knew it. We had proven it a long time ago. And now they're going to see if it's really true. And they're coming out with tears in their eyes, crying, raging against the government. So anyway, let me continue with this review, and I will try to refrain from any more asides during the rest of this. I'm going to read the whole thing to you. 4 years ago Saturday, April 19th, 1993, the compound of the Branch Davidians was burned to the ground, ending a 51-day standoff with the FBI. About 80 people died, including children and women. 2 years later, on April 19th, 1995, in a twisted form of payback, the federal building in Oklahoma City was blown up. It was the worst single act of domestic political terrorism in American history. Now, I do have to say this, because no one has ever proven that this was done as revenge against Waco. It has been alleged by the media only. Not even the government, not even the FBI has made statements like this. I continue. One of the accused, Timothy McVeigh, had visited Waco and has said how profoundly its destruction by government forces affected his political thinking. Such feelings are not the sole property of the radical right. Congressional hearings 2 years ago were highly critical of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, whose botched raid, in which four ATF agents died, spurred the standoff, and the FBI. A startling new documentary, which has been airing in selected cinemas since February the 28th, raises even more disturbing questions. Waco, Rules of Engagement, presents evidence, some of it from previously unpublicized government videotapes and film, suggesting that both the ATF and FBI have consistently lied about both their motivations and activities at Waco. Salon spoke with the documentary's executive producer and co-writer, Dan Gifford, a former news reporter for CNN, ABC News, and the McNeil Lehrer News Hour. So you see, people who made this film, folks, are not some fly-by-night wackos out here, and they are liberal, left-wing, socialist journalists with a long history of, quote, credibility, end quote, on major communist news network television. I continue. In some respects, your documentary confirms the worst suspicions of far-right conspiracy theorists. For example, among the conclusions you draw was that the action that led to the Waco disaster, the ATF's initial raid on the Branch Davidians, was primarily a publicity stunt. According to interviews we have with former ATF agents, yes, at the time, their appropriations were due to be debated in Congress. They had suffered a number of recent debacles, including Ruby Ridge, the Idaho cabin in which fugitive right-wing militia leader Randy Weaver's wife, Vicky, and 14-year-old son, Sammy, were killed by government snipers in 1992. Well, I can see, I can't keep from making asides, folks, because this is a lie. You see, Randy Weaver was never a militia leader. He was never in a militia. Randy Weaver was a white separatist. He wasn't a racist. He didn't condemn other races. He just didn't believe that they should live together. And he was a loner. He didn't associate with too many people. Lived alone up in the mountains of Idaho. He had nothing to do with militias. He was not a militia leader. It's a lie. I continue. 60 Minutes had done a couple of very negative stories on the ATF concerning sexual discrimination and harassment and racial discrimination. There was even talk of disbanding the agency. So they needed publicity, which is not unique. Government agencies do this. They traditionally pull some sort of publicity stunt before they go in for a hearing. It's a turf thing.
A power thing.
The documentary also suggested the ATF perhaps launched the raid even though there was no sign of unlawful resistance from the Branch Davidians. That's the claim of the surviving Davidians. There's no way to determine that absolutely because, as the film points out, all of the physical evidence that might enable you to come to a conclusion has disappeared. It's been destroyed. In particular, a door from the compound that was riddled with bullet holes. Yes, according to the ATF, the portion of the door which had the bullet holes in it was destroyed in the fire. The Branch Davidians say the holes were caused by bullets coming in, but now there's no proof. The ATF had a tremendous number of video cameras out there, but many of the tapes are amazingly blank. You're saying basically that the ATF raid was unprovoked. There's no way to prove it. The physical evidence has all been destroyed, but if the Branch Davidians had the kind of weaponry the government said it had, they would have blown away the entire ATF force. Jack Zimmerman, a former Marine colonel with a lot of combat experience, who is now a lawyer for the surviving Davidians, made that point. So did the local sheriff. On the audio tapes, you hear David Koresh claiming that he went down to the door and said, "Hey, there's women and children. Let's talk about this." And the ATF started shooting at them. And in the documentary, you show how the chief of the ATF operation, who was negotiating with Koresh, lied about the weaponry the government had brought to bear. First, he claimed that there were no guns on the government helicopters, then saying, well, there were no mounted guns. That was Jim Cavanaugh, You saw him later testifying in Congress in a gray suit. That's one of the things that amazed us when we were putting together the documentary, catching them in lie after lie after lie. What other lies stood out? The story that the FBI was telling everyone about David Koresh promising to come out 5 times. If you listen to the audio tapes, you can't find these 5 times. You might also remember that the FBI said the Branch Davidians' home video would show them to be a bunch of wild-eyed, crazy people. What it showed was absolutely the opposite. But most people, whether they've seen the documentary or not, would still say Koresh was a sociopath, obsessed with Armageddon and a final face-off with outside forces. Well, that was the assumption of Alan Stone, the professor of law and psychiatry at Harvard, brought in by the government during the siege to analyze the mindset of the Branch Davidians. He says he found that was not the case, not the case, that there were some very intelligent and learned people in there. A religious expert said that what Koresh preached was fundamentally no different from what you'd hear in any fundamental Baptist church or charismatic church. This whole thing about the apocalypse, the focus on the book of Revelations, the second coming. But weren't there complaints from the neighbors about gun-related activities at the compound? Well, again, that was the story that was sold. We found, and the local sheriff verified this, that one person once thought he heard automatic weapon fire. But there was no proof that there was anything illegal. People we interviewed said the Branch Davidians minded their own business. They had good relations with their neighbors. That one of them came over to shoot guns with them. That's not the way the Davidians have been portrayed. But there was the congressional testimony of Kiri Jewell, who claimed she was sexually abused by Koresh. The issue of child abuse is totally irrelevant to what happened. Neither the ATF nor FBI has the authority or jurisdiction to enforce state child abuse laws. The local sheriff we interviewed said a case had never been made, that there wasn't enough evidence. Some of the allegations apparently came from former Davidians who had had a falling out with Koresh and left. And as an aside, ladies and gentlemen, the most damaging testimony came from Mark Breaux, who is blind, whom I met myself, couldn't see me, 1 foot in front of his face when I was standing there talking to him, who claimed that he had seen with his eyes David Koresh molesting young children. And it was a lie, because Mark Breaux cannot see, could not see, and has been that way since birth. Some of the allegations apparently came from former Davidians who had had a falling out with Koresh and left. Mark Breaux had been in a contest with David Koresh for leadership of the church, folks. I continue. Yet child abuse was the reason Janet Reno gave for giving the go-ahead for the final assault. Yes, that was the reason she gave. It was told to her by the FBI, which was clearly looking for a way to find her hot button so she would give the go-ahead. You imply that just before the FBI went in there was the possibility that the situation could have been resolved. The Davidians thought they had a deal, that Koresh would finish writing his 7 seals and then come out. The reason they thought that was not only that they were told that by the negotiators, but that the FBI had sent in typewriter ribbons and batteries as if to say, stay there, finish your writing. But you say what the FBI had in mind when they finally went in was at least partly revenge for the shooting of the 4 ATF agents. I'd say revenge is a fairly apt word. When every law enforcement officer is killed, what happens? Other law enforcement agents all focus on the people who did it. There was a lot of testosterone outside the compound, a lot of shoving matches, virtual fist fights. Henry Root, one of 3 independent reviewers brought in by the Justice Department to report on what happened at Waco, said one of the most stunning things, that the raid was, in large part, meant to scare the public and to seek retribution and to enforce the morals of our society, what he called the psyche of right thinking. And folks, isn't that what I told you, that I believed the whole thing was about from the beginning? And they just confirm it. I continue. It's unclear from the documentary whether you believe the FBI started the fires in the compound on purpose or whether they were just grossly negligent. We have a former Houston fire chief saying the building was like a pot-bellied stove, and with the aerosol gas the FBI threw in, it was bound to virtually explode. We did not say that the FBI deliberately started the fire, but again, there was this repeated lying that they did not have any munitions that would start a fire. We have an expert maintaining that the FBI used gunfire or some sort of projectile in the building. They had flashbang grenades. Those were clearly incendiary things. They start fires. Then there's that infrared tape in the documentary where you seem to see people trying to leave the Davidian building being shot at by government agents. That's very disturbing. I've no doubt the FBI will say something like, quote, that was lightning bugs or a reflection, end quote. The official explanation is that the Davidians who were shot had committed suicide. Well, look at the video. Here's all this automatic weapon fire being poured into the building, and the FBI is saying they never fired so much as a single shot. Ross Davidson is a regular contributor to Salon and other papers and magazines across the country. The biggest and most damaging evidence against the FBI that they did set the fires and did intend to murder all of those people, ladies and gentlemen, was that they notified the local Waco Hospital and Dallas Parkland Hospital in Dallas, Texas, to be ready. This was before the fire started. It was way early that morning before the sun even came up. Notified them to be ready to accept large numbers of burn casualties from Waco, Texas. So, there you have it. For whatever it may be worth. Well, I've got to give you this one, folks, because for years I've been reading that everything that you eat or drink is going to kill you. It doesn't matter what it is. If you eat it or drink it, it's going to kill you. It's going to give you cancer. It's going to eat your liver. It's going to cause Alzheimer's or something. So here's a bit of good news. It's something that you can do, that you can put in your body that won't kill you, that will actually help you as long as you don't do it to excess. And this is from France. They say, this is from the Boston Globe, 1997, April 18th. April 18th, 1997, the Boston Globe, and this information comes from France. And it says, modern drinking, already thought to lower the risk of heart disease and stroke, may also ward off dementia and Alzheimer's disease. And that's enough to get me into two or three glasses of wine a day, folks. And not only lowers the risk of heart disease and stroke, but may also ward off dementia and Alzheimer's disease. At a presentation Thursday in Boston, a French scientist from the wine-growing region of Bordeaux reported that elderly residents there had a much lower risk of developing dementia by age 70 if they drank three or four glasses of wine daily, an intake the French consider moderate. And it's not just the French. If you've ever been to Spain, Portugal, France, Germany, any of those countries, In Germany, it's beer, and they have wine there too, but most people drink beer. But in Spain, Portugal, France, and Italy, I left out Italy, Spain, Portugal, France, and Italy, everybody drinks wine all day long, ladies and gentlemen, all day long. Instead of drinking water, they drink wine. And I, as a child, we lived in the Azores Islands, which is a part of Portugal. And whenever we went to visit in a Portuguese home, everyone was served wine, even the children. Even us. And we were, oh gosh, how old was I? I think I was in the third, fourth, and most of the fifth grade before we left there. And my brother and sister were 2 years younger than I was. Still are 2 years younger than I am. So, folks, what he's saying here is true. Three or four glasses of wine daily is moderate for France, Portugal, Spain, or Italy. And if you think of the beer equivalent, it's probably moderate for Germany, too. They drink an awful lot of beer in Germany, I got to tell you. Unbelievable amount of beer, as a matter of fact. He says here, we are quite confident of the results, said Dr. Jean-Marc Orgagozu, chairman of neurology at the University of Bordeaux. The message is not for all to drink, certainly not. The message of moderation is very important, but there is ample evidence that drinking moderately can be protective. Now, medical professionals here in this country have said the same thing about heart attack and stroke. However, I've never heard anybody in this country make any relationship to the intake of alcohol with the lack of dementia or Alzheimer's disease in old age. But the French are making that connection now. Compared to non-drinkers, moderate wine consumers had 65% less likelihood of developing Alzheimer's or other types of dementia over the 5-year study period, Orgagozu told scientists at the American Academy of Neurology meetings. So, I'm not telling you to drink, folks. I'm not telling you not to drink. All I'm telling you is there's a bit of news that we don't normally hear. Usually we hear, if you eat this, you'll die in 10 years. Every time you take a puff of this, you take 3 days off your life. Every time you eat this, you increase your risk of cancer before you're 40. And every time you do this, it makes you fall down the stairs and blah, 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 blah. I'm sick of it. So, since everything kills you, folks, and I got to eat to live, I stopped listening to it a long time ago. But for those of you who listen to it, I thought I'd give you some good news for a change. Drink 3 to 4 glasses of wine a day, if you so desire. I'm not telling you to do that. And you may decrease your risk of Alzheimer's disease. You definitely will decrease your risk of heart attack and stroke. And that's been said by doctors all over the place. Here's another ping on the FBI. I mean, the FBI has taken it, folks, and they deserve it. We found out that the crime lab has been sending people to prison on lies for years. They're not interested in justice. They're interested in convictions, and they'll lie to get the convictions. They'll put anybody in jail as long as they can get a conviction. That's all they care about. That's it. Recently, the FBI gave the White House thousands of FBI records on American citizens against the law. They did it. Tried to blame it on this White House security guy. But no, the FBI knew better than to do it in the first place. So that's the FBI's fault. It was an FBI sniper who murdered Vicki Weaver at Ruby Ridge in Idaho. That's right. It was an FBI sniper. A scum-sucking, puke-faced little coward named Lon Horiuchi shot her in the head while she was standing in the doorway holding her little baby to her breast. Did they press charges against him? Was he ever tried for murder? Nope. Nope, so they changed his name, put him in the witness protection program, and hid him out, where he remains in hiding to this day. The FBI murdered the Branch Davidians in Waco, Texas, burnt them to a crisp, and as they tried to escape out the back door, as you will see in this film that I just read you the review on. By the way, that was one of the mildest reviews that I've read. They machine gunned them. And I can go on and on and on. They planted bombs in people's cars in order to arrest them and send them to jail for being bombers. Now, the FBI, it seems, has destroyed Whitewater evidence. And this is from the Washington Weekly, February the 17th, 1997. Whitewater witness Judge David Hale dropped a bombshell in an interview with the Associated Press last week. The FBI has destroyed evidence he had against Bill Clinton. On July 21, 1993, FBI agents raided the office of David Hale and seized his loan files. Among the loan files were the file on the illegal $300,000 loan that Clinton pressured David Hale to make to Susan McDougal. When the government filed suit against David Hale for loan fraud, Clinton appointee, U.S. Attorney Paula Casey, refused to hear Hale's evidence against Bill Clinton as part of a plea bargain. Hale's attorney needed access to the files and asked the FBI to see it. The file on the $300,000 loan was 3 to 4 inches thick when the FBI took it, but when my attorney and I asked to see it a month or so later, the U.S. Attorney's office gave us maybe an inch of stuff, Hale says. Jim McDougal now confirms the allegation David Hale has made against the president. McDougal recently told New Yorker correspondent James Stewart that Clinton was present at a 1986 meeting in which the illegal $300,000 loan to McDougal's former wife, Susan, was discussed with David Hale. The allegation of FBI destruction of Whitewater evidence comes at the heels of evidence of FBI witness tampering in the Vince Foster and Oklahoma bombing investigations, as well as intimidation and retaliation against FBI whistleblowers Dennis Scugliambrini and Fred Whitehurst in the Filegate and Oklahoma bomb investigations. If you trust the FBI, you're out of your mind. If they come and knock at your door and you even say hello to them, if you even talk to them for a second, you're out of your mind. You're crazy. And if they say you have to talk to them, that's a lie. You don't ever have to talk to anyone. The only time you absolutely must say something is if you're subpoenaed in a court of law or to Congress as a witness, then you must say something. And you know, all you have to say is, I plead the Fifth Amendment. You don't have to talk to any of these people ever. You do have to say something if you're subpoenaed as a witness in Congress or in a court of law, but all you have to say is, I'm not going to say anything because it might tend to incriminate me, and I call into effect my protection under the Fifth Article in Amendment to the Constitution or of the Bill of Rights. Don't talk to these clowns. Anything that you say can be twisted around and used against you, and you can find yourself in jail for nothing at all. Nothing. Well, here's another one. Here's another one. This is from the Independent Film and Video Monthly, April 1997. It's a magazine, folks. The Independent Film and Video Monthly, April 1997. It's one of the biggie magazines of the film industry for independent film and video makers. And the other winners are by Patricia Thompson and Kara Merkes. In addition to recognizing the films that received official awards, the Independent here presents its own meritorious honors. Most likely to be suppressed. He worked at McNeil Lehrer and CNN. She is a self-described tabloid babe, having worked at Current Affair. Together, Amy Summer Gifford and her husband Dan Gifford executive produced a powerful documentary about one of America's most misunderstood events, the disastrous FBI-led assault on an obscure religious sect outside of Waco, Texas. On April 19, 1993, during an assault on the Branch Davidian compound, 76 Branch Davidians died in a blazing fire. The government said the Davidians committed mass suicide. The evidence shows otherwise. Quote, our goal going into the documentary was to figure out how this happened, says Ms. Gifford, of their 165-minute film Waco, The Rules of Engagement. The real tragedy is that everyone thought they were doing the right thing. The road to hell is paved with good intentions. End quote. Folks, I got to take a little break here and drink some water. Be right back. I just barely got through that, but I didn't get through it, as a matter of fact. With director, co-writer, editor William Gazecki, the Giffords spent almost 2 years producing the film. Its detailed analysis of those fateful 51 days is based on previously unseen footage shot by the Davidians during the siege. Amateur video by an FBI sniper. Infrared surveillance footage of the fire, news footage of government hearings about the fiasco, and interviews with survivors, most of which is made up of government video and film footage. In its uncritical support of David Koresh and the activities of the Branch Davidians, the film seems at times driven by an anti-government conspiracy theory agenda, but it unearths important material in the search for what happened at Waco. When asked what prompted their interest in the subject, Ms. Gifford says, 200 years of uninterrupted democratic rule is something I, as an American, am very proud of. I think that, as a country, we have the strength to look at this event. So, there you have that. And from Newsday, April 20th, 1997, that's yesterday, FBI. TWA focus on one theory may soon rule out bomb/missile causes by Lauren Terrazano and Robert E. Kessler, staff writers. Basically what this says, folks, is the FBI says it wasn't a missile, it wasn't a bomb, it was a mechanical defect. Yet they cannot produce this mechanical defect. However, we can produce over 150, actually, close to 300, folks, but we've narrowed it down to right around 150 that we know absolutely are credible witnesses who saw a missile shoot up from the ocean and hit that plane. There are also some pictures taken by people who were on the beach that night that clearly shows a missile in the sky. Some of these have been shown on television. And so even though they cannot produce a mechanical defect, they're saying now that it's a mechanical defect, and even though they know that there are at least 300 witnesses who saw a missile shoot up from the ocean and hit that plane, they are saying positively that it is not a missile or terrorist bomb event. But it doesn't help those of us who have to fly now because of all the legislation that's been passed in the wake of all of this, because they initially said that it was the militia, patriots, constitutionists, a right-wing, a terrorist, a fundamentalist, a Christian, constitutionist, people who blew up that plane. Remember that? Remember that, huh, folks? Well, they passed all this legislation that now all automobiles have to be searched. Against the Fourth Amendment, but it doesn't matter. It's got to be searched. Every bit of your car has to be searched if you go in and park at the airport. They can search all of your luggage, whether you're taking an international flight or not. Now you have to provide identification, and they're trying to make you provide social security numbers. And now they're making a database of and a profile of people who shouldn't fly. So So if you fit the profile accidentally, whatever their profile is, I have no idea what it is, they're not going to let you on an airplane. You see? And now they're telling us that it wasn't a right-wing fanatic terrorist militia, wacko, fundamentalist, Christian constitutionist that bombed the plane. No, it's a mechanical defect is what they're trying to tell us, even though we know absolutely for sure that it was a missile. Who fired the missile? I don't know. I have no idea. And I'm not going to venture a guess because the guess is just that, speculation. We do know positively that there's no court in the world that would not convict the missile for downing that plane with the number of witnesses that you could produce to substantiate it. Isn't that amazing? Combined with the photographs of the missile in the air. Tough on crime. Oh, you're going to love this, folks. This is one of those things that makes me want to scream. And run off and, you know, just live on a beach somewhere forever. This is insanity. Listen to this. You're going to die. You're just going to die laughing. Washington, D.C. Oh, now you know why you're going to die laughing. This is some words of wisdom out of Washington, D.C., where there is no wisdom whatsoever. In a bold move designed to halt the spread of violent crime in America, President Clinton unveiled his new Get Tough on Crime sticker campaign on Monday. Last Monday. Listen to this. Oh, this is a doozy, folks. Quote, "We must send a strong message to the nation's criminals," end quote, said Clinton, displaying one of the new 3x6-inch stickers before an assemblage of reporters and law enforcement officials. He says, and I quote, "These stickers, emblazoned with the phrase, 'Get tough on crime,' will send a loud and clear message to all potential lawbreakers that crime will not be tolerated," end quote. help. Oh, dear Lord, please save us from ourselves. According to Clinton, the stickers, which feature a special easy peel tab on the back to increase ease of peeling, should reduce crime. Get this, folks. Get this. These stickers, emblazoned with the phrase, "Get tough on crime," will send a loud and clear message to all potential lawbreakers that crime will not be tolerated. According to... And I couldn't hear a thing. Because I've got them plugged into the... recorder that's recording the studio tape of this broadcast, and it reached the end and I didn't see it. So when it stops, it tells me by cutting off the sound to my earphones. Okay, let me back up and try this again. Maybe I'll get through it. According to Clinton, the stickers, which feature a special easy peel tab on the back to increase ease of peeling, get this, should reduce crime by up to 75% when prominently displayed at eye level in high crime areas. Bullshit. This is got to be the biggest indication that William Jefferson Clinton is absolutely insane that I've ever seen in my life. Listen to this. Quote, "To those who would ignore the stickers," he warned, said Clinton, speaking directly into the television camera, "this sticker is extremely adhesive, and its message is printed in bold, uppercase, two-color type. This is not a mere show of concern. It is a serious deterrent to criminals everywhere," end quote. Do you believe this? Has this guy suffered a major meltdown? Has he suffered a major meltdown? A tougher version of the sticker is currently being developed for use in particularly dangerous areas. The stickers will be 1 square inch larger than the current ones and will feature glitter over the words tough and crime. And there's a picture here. It says above, hoodlums assault a driver in a dangerous section of Los Angeles. In the future, such motorists would be protected by an anti-crime sticker prominently displayed in their vehicle's front window. All residents of high-risk areas will also be issued a personal defense kit, which includes a set of 10 emergency-only stickers that they may apply to a nearby wall or lamppost if violently attacked. This is a spoof, folks, on Clinton's suggestion that we send a strong message to nation's criminals by putting out these 3x6-inch stickers all over the place that says, get tough on crime. It's supposed to send a big message to them and reduce crime by 75%. And the rest of this is just a spoof. So, you know, don't take all this seriously. You're not supposed to wait until you're assaulted and then stick this sticker on the assaulter's forehead, and it's supposed to result in him stopping attacking you. It's probably make him madder. Insanity. Clinton wants to stop crime by making stickers that we're supposed to plaster all over the country that says, get tough on crime. And that's supposed to stop crime. I don't think so. As a missing A-10, ladies and gentlemen, an A-10 is an airplane. An A-10 Thunderbolt. It's an airplane that can carry bombs and has a machine gun on it and all kinds of bad stuff. Apparently, this plane was going on a regular training exercise in Arizona, and at a particular point in time, he just took a left turn and went to Colorado. That's what they say. Anyway, I don't really know what happened to this airplane, except the Air Force, the government, everybody else says they couldn't find it. It disappeared. They don't know where it went. And today, they've issued a press release. Actually, it was yesterday. They issued a press release saying that they found what is likely the wreckage of this missing bomb-laden warplane, but there is, so far, no sign of the pilot. And the wreckage is on a sheer, snow-covered cliff in the central Rocky Mountains. And this all really sounds really weird to me. I mean, why would a pilot going on a routine training mission jet plane that costs a couple of million bucks and carrying a couple of 500-pound bombs and some pretty heavy-duty machine guns on it, take a left turn and go to Colorado and then crash into a mountain? I mean, that just doesn't make any sense to me. I don't believe the bit about the he stole the plane to bomb the courthouse. I don't believe that either. I don't believe that he stole the plane to land it at some secret base so the militia could use it. I know that's not true because I'm the director of intelligence for the largest militia in this country. And I can tell you for a fact, it's absolutely not true. But why this guy would first deviate from his training mission and fly into Colorado and then crash this thing into a cliff? Everybody who knew him said he wasn't suicidal and he wasn't crazy, he wasn't a wacko, he wasn't into any weird stuff or into any strange religions or anything like that. He was just a regular Air Force pilot who liked to fly. And next thing you know, they go up on a routine training mission and he disappears from the formation that he's supposed to be flying with. And they say that all of this is reports. You can't believe what these people tell us anymore. They say they tracked the plane to Colorado, that it was flying very low, following the terrain, and now they're telling us that they found the wreckage of this plane at some high cliff in the snow in Colorado. So I don't know what the truth is. I don't think anybody does. And I'll tell you something else. They haven't positively identified this supposed wreckage, if it is wreckage, because all they saw was some paper and some gray and yellow stuff in the snow. And they don't even really know if it's the wreckage of a plane, much less the wreckage of this plane, but they're saying that they believe that it is. So, just want to let you know that that's been done. What it means, I don't know, folks. I have no idea. I don't know what happened to the pilot. I don't know what happened to the plane. I don't know why what happened. I don't know where it went. I don't know if that's the plane that they say that they have seen wreckage of. Now, this next one makes me angry. It's probably going to make you angry, too. That is if you're the kind of person that, you know, really cares about things. Because if you really do, you've got to get angry about this. It's just one of those things that you're supposed to get angry about. Oh. The Social Security Administration has told its administrative judges to ignore the rulings of federal courts and follow the policy of the Social Security Administration, even though it may conflict with the law. Think I'm kidding? No, folks, this is from the New York Times News Service, Washington, April 21st. That's today. In a move that could delay or deny benefits for tens of thousands and maybe even millions of people, the Social Security Administration has told its judges that they should disregard federal court precedents if those rulings conflict with agency policies. The order, issued as the agency faces a huge backlog of disputed claims, has drawn protests from federal courts, members of Congress, and agency employees. But who cares? I mean, isn't this what all the federal agencies are doing now? They've thrown the Constitution in the trash. They don't give a damn about the law. And they're doing whatever the hell they want to do, no matter who it hurts, no matter how bad it is. Because I'm telling you, folks, I've been telling you this for years, the socialists, the Marxists, the communists have taken over the positions in our government, and they're hell-bent on flushing the United States of America right down the toilet, because the only thing that stands in the way of their one-world utopian socialist whatever it is. Moreover, it is being compared to positions taken in the early 1980s by the Reagan administration, which said it was bound only by Supreme Court decisions and did not have to acquiesce in decisions of lower courts that contradicted its reading of the Social Security law. Democrats denounced the Reagan administration's practice as lawless, and the administration took a more moderate position after Congress made clear that it disapproved of the practice. This week, the House and Means Committee will hold a hearing to examine the practice. So now the Democrats are doing what they criticized Reagan for doing, but the Democrats aren't even saying that they're going to be bound by the Supreme Court decisions. They're telling their administrative law judges to ignore everything. Ignore the law. Ignore the rulings of the courts and do what we tell you to do. Oh, brother. The Social Security Agency recently told its administrative law judges who rule on claims for benefits that they might face remedial training and disciplinary action if they did not follow the agency's policies or if their productivity was considered too low, even though it may be against the law. And here's the quote, direct quote from the Social Security Administration. Listen to this, quote, "An administrative law judge is bound to follow agency policy even if, in the administrative law judge's opinion, the policy is contrary to law," end quote. This is read right out of a confidential memorandum to the administrative law judges of the Social Security Administration by the director of the Social Security Administration. Oh, brother. That means that if you file a claim for Social Security, hey, good luck. Good luck, bud. All those years you've been paying in, good luck. You see, there isn't any money in the Social Security Trust Fund. You know why, folks? Because there is no Social Security Trust Fund. All trusts of the United States government are spelled out in the law and in the section in the United States Code which delineates and outlines and spells out and names all of the trusts administered by the United States government. There is no Social Security Trust Fund. Never was, never will be. And if you read the Social Security law, you will see that it was never an insurance policy. You're not paying for insurance. It was never, ever a trust.
It is a tax, ladies and gentlemen, and all of the money goes in to the general fund, and Congress and the government has been using all those funds in any way they wish for all of these years, contrary to what you've all thought. And the money doesn't exist. If they don't get money from somewhere next year, other than what you pay in the Social Security, they can't pay you your Social Security. It's like a pyramid scheme. You sell one, in order to pay the commissions, you got to sell two more. And pretty soon, whoever the last guy that bought, they're left holding the bag for the whole thing, which comes tumbling down. And that's the truth of the matter. And that's why the Social Security system is ultimately going to fail. It has to fail. There's nothing that can stop it from failing because the money has been spent a long time ago, ladies and gentlemen. And all of these congressmen and senators and politicians and people in government who stand up and tell you not to worry, the Social Security Trust Fund is okay, they're lying to you. They're lying out their teeth. They're the most chronic, habitual, bold-faced liars that have ever lived. There is no trust fund for Social Security. And there is no money in any trust fund for Social Security. Never was, is not now, and unless they pass some legislation establishing a trust fund tomorrow, never will be. If you don't believe it, ask them to show you the trust in the law. As a trust, who the trustees are, and where the money is being held. You want to see some red faces real quick? You know, it just amazes me that so many people are such fools. You know, I hate to say that, folks, but it's the truth. All of you elderly folk are so worried about your Social Security that you think you paid into as insurance payments and that you're due this money. You're not due any of it, according to the law. They don't have to pay it to you. But they can't figure out how to get out of their scam. It's suicide if they don't. But you see, there's no money. And pretty soon, it's all going to be obvious to anybody. And they keep telling you about this trust fund. Not a one of you have demanded to see the evidence that such a fund exists. Not one of you anywhere. It's amazing to me. Just blindly believe these people. You think the government would do you no wrong. Folks, the government is run by people. The government doesn't exist except on paper and in your mind. The paper is the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and the lawful amendments thereto. That's the government. And if they're not conforming to that document, then there is no government. It's just a bunch of people running amok, doing what they want to do. For their own agendas and for the agendas of people who put money in their pockets. It's what you don't seem to understand. That piece of paper known as the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and the lawful amendments thereto cannot do anybody wrong. And when you say the government would not do me wrong, if that's what you're talking about, yeah, you're right. But unfortunately, it's people in the government who apply the law and who administer the law and the government. And they do lots of wrong all the time. Just like you do. And your neighbors. And the people you work with. They all gossip and scheme and conspire and try to get promoted. And they look out for themselves. And somebody slips a few bucks here and a few bucks there. It is no different in Washington, D.C. than it was in your high school. Or in your hometown. People are people. Just because you send them to Washington doesn't change any of that. So now the Social Security has joined the BATF and the FBI and all of the other scum-sucking, puke-faced, socialist, traitorous subversives in our government in telling their administrative law judges to ignore the law. Do what we tell you. Just do it or else. Or else you're going to get reprimanded or fired. Or we'll send you to a re-education training center. Oh, boy. By the way, that's what communists do. If you're politically incorrect, you go to a re-education center. Isn't that what he just, I just read it to you, didn't I? I got a little cold, so in order to keep from having to sniffle every 3 minutes while I'm on the air, I have taken some nose spray, and that has sort of seeped down into my throat and dried out my throat, so I have to take a sip of water quite frequently during this broadcast. Another piece of news. 6 of the Branch Davidians who were put in jail wrongly because of what happened in Waco have now lost their Supreme Court appeals. And the Supreme Court did not give any explanation, which they normally do in normal, lawful cases. They normally will issue an opinion. In fact, normally they'll make the opinion of all of the judges on the issue public. Not so in this case. They just turned down the appeal and that's it. No explanation. No nothing. None of the opinions of the judges have been made public. So that's another travesty. If what they did was right, why don't they make the opinions public like they do in every other Supreme Court ruling? Those people are political prisoners, ladies and gentlemen. Here's another one. Computer systems may someday copy a person's voice. That's a lie. The Central Intelligence Agency, the Office of Naval Intelligence, Army G2 Intelligence, the Air Force Office of Special Investigation, Counterintelligence, has been doing it for many, many years. They had the computer capability to duplicate perfectly any person's voice. When I was a member of the Office of Naval Intelligence many, many years ago, ladies and gentlemen, I left the Navy on December the 11th, 1975. That's how long ago it was. But civilian corporations are now beginning to perfect the technology. And this comes from Tokyo, from the New York Times News Service. Tokyo, April 21st, 1997. Move over, Rich Little. Researchers are developing electronic impersonators, computer systems that can speak in a particular person's voice. Nobody will be safe when this happens, public, in the public sector. Nobody's safe in the silent wars of intelligence organizations, I can tell you, and haven't been for many, many years. They could do this when I was in the Navy, folks. Quote, the systems, which will take some years to perfect, ha, 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 start with an actual recording of a person and break it down into individual sounds, such as those of syllables or letters. The computer can then string these sound elements together in new sequences to utter sentences in the person's voice that the person never actually said. Now, I'm going to tell you something. Whatever you perceive as the state of the art of technology in the public sector, in secret, in the military, in government, they're 50 to 100 years ahead of that. When I was in the United States Navy, folks, we had computer servers, networks, and workstations. That's right. That have just been developed over the last few years for the public sector. Now, let me say this again, just in case you're not listening. Whatever you perceive as the ultimate state of the art of any technology, I don't care what it is, in the public sector, in secret, the military and the government is at least 50 to 100 years ahead of your perception. The computer servers, networks, and workstations that you're just now, over the last few years, seeing developed in the public sector, were in use by the military and the government, ladies and gentlemen, back in the early 70s and the late 60s. And that's a fact.
and much, much more. Much, much more. If we have a recording of your voice, we can make you say almost anything, said Nick Campbell, the leader of a group that has developed, not going to develop, not might develop, but has developed such a system at ATR Interpreting Telecommunications Research Laboratories in Kyoto, Japan. Indeed, the computer can even make a person's voice spout off in a language that he or she does not understand. Can make you sound drunk. Can make you sound elated. Can make you sound insane or sleepy or suicidal or emotionally upset. You hear what I'm saying? Some technology is good, folks, but we've gone over the edge. And we went over the edge a long time ago. Those of you in the public sector who've never been in the nether regions of government or the military, projects, agencies, and operations, you haven't got a clue. You just simply haven't got a clue. And I feel for you, because when it finally becomes evident what's really going on, some of you are just likely to lose your mind. Just likely to go right off the deep end. Have you heard, folks, that old President Clinton, old Billy Boy, William Jefferson Clinton, President of the United States of America, how he got there, I'll never know in a million years. How such a lying, promiscuous crook ever got into the White House is beyond me. But he likes the concept of volunteering your services for the community so much that he wants to make it mandatory. That's right. He wants to make it absolutely mandatory. He wants to make volunteerism mandatory for a lot of people. Young people in particular, but adults too. Now, when he makes it mandatory, will it still be volunteerism? Do you think? And how many people who would normally volunteer will stop volunteering when they find out that it's mandatory? And when they used to volunteer and do it willingly and put their whole effort into it and really, really do something good for the community, feel bad, you know, feel real good about it, how many of them do you think will feel good about it when it's mandatory? And how many do you think will stop, you know, putting everything into it and start trying to figure out how to get out of it once they find out that now it's not, it's not because they want to do it anymore, it's because they have to do it. Not only that, but he wants to pay you for it. Just in case mandating service doesn't work, Clinton is proposing in his radio address to pay volunteers. Oh, boy. Socialists are so deluded. I don't even know what kind of a world they live in, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, you know, I can understand how a sociopath can lie to somebody else. But when they lie to themselves and believe they're a lie, and they know they're lying, and that's just beyond my comprehension. It's beyond my ability to even remotely understand that kind of thinking. But that's the way socialists think. That's the way they do things. They're chronic liars. They lie to the American public. They lie to everyone they know. Then they turn around and lie to each other. And they know they're lying, but they believe it. And they pretend like it's all okay, and they smile, and they just love each other. It's amazing. See, they want to teach young people that a desire to help their neighbors is a good thing, and so that they're going to mandate volunteerism. And in case the mandate doesn't work, they're going to bribe them with some money. See, you see, volunteering out of a genuine urge to help other people has always been something that Americans have always done. 101.1 FM Eager is a community service station. We don't get a penny from anybody for operating 101.1 FM Eager under the Independent Foundation Trust as a charity for the community.
We volunteer because we know that it helps the community have another point of view. And it's also nice for people to hear uninterrupted music whenever there's not any regular programming on 101.1 FM Eager. The Worldwide Freedom Radio Network is not making any money. We're doing it to be able to offer Americans an alternative point of view and be able to hear another voice and to be able to document and source information so that they don't have to depend upon the Communist News Network's lies. And many, many other things. And we're not the only ones. It happens all across America. There are people working in hospitals and community centers and Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts and teaching swimming in the summertime to help children learn how to swim so they won't drown if they fall in the water. Charities helping the homeless all across this country. Herr Clinton doesn't think that that's good enough. He likes volunteering so much that he wants to make it mandatory. And once it's mandatory, if that doesn't work, which it won't, I can tell you right now, Americans don't like to be told to do something if they don't have to do it, or if they don't want to do it. They like to do it out of the goodness of their heart. So I can tell you right now, it's not going to work. It's going to turn people off. It's going to make them angry. So in case that doesn't work, he wants to appeal to the base nature of humanity. He wants to pay them some money. He wants to hand out $500 checks to students who perform outstanding volunteer service. $500 is a lot of money to a student. And when they've been bribed in that manner, it's not volunteer service, it's a job. For Pete's sake. Shouldn't say for Pete's sake. Pete might get angry at me. Whoever Pete is. Oh, my goodness. A federal court has also dealt a harsh blow to the Federal Election Commission's attempts to regulate issue advocacy. Ads that the agency believe have crossed the line into express advocacy. U.S. Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that the FCC must pay the legal fees of the Christian Action Network, a conservative nonprofit organization that the FCC sued unsuccessfully. What did they sue them for? Well, following the 1992 campaign cycle, the FEC, that's the Federal Election Commission, charged that the Christian Action Network's television ad attacking then-presidential candidate Bill Clinton for supporting special rights for homosexuals violated the law because it expressly advocated Clinton's defeat, even though it didn't contain the words vote for or vote against. Well, they lost. You can now attack them. And even if the intent of the attack is to make sure the person doesn't get elected, as long as you don't say vote against or vote for, they can't touch you. That's what the court rules. Stick them. Go get them. Eat them up, Buttercup. Remember, socialism sucks, and so do socialists. The hour of the time until April the 30th, that is brought to you by Swiss America Trading in Phoenix, Arizona. Call them. Ask for a copy of the free newsletter. Tell them that you're a steady listener to the hour of the time and thank them for having sponsored this broadcast for the last 4 years. Whether they continue to sponsor this broadcast or not, they have done us a great service. They have been loyal and true. And if you, the listening audience, had been loyal and true to them, they would still be sponsoring this broadcast. Ask them how you can get your hands on some real money and then do it.
1-800-289-2646. That's 1-800-289-2646. Do it right now, folks. You'd be glad that you did. U.S. government sued for radiation. Radiation experiments, that is, on people. People. Yeah, that's right. People. You know, just like you and me. Or you and me. Or you and me. I keep saying that over and over again because I want to impress upon you that they are just like you and me. They're people. No different. And I'm part of them, you see. Because the people that they've been experimenting on this time are Native Americans. The law firms of Chamberlain, Neaton, and Johnson, and Baker, Donaldson, Behrman, and Caldwell. I like that. I'm going to say that again. The law firms of Chamberlain, Neaton, and Johnson, and Baker, Donaldson, Behrman, and Caldwell announced today that they have filed a class action suit in the U.S. District Court of Seattle, Western District of Washington, on behalf of individual Native American citizens of the regions adjacent to or in the vicinity of the Hanford Nuclear Reservation, located in South Central Washington State, against the United States government for conducting wrongful human radiological experiments on their people without their knowledge or their permission. And this wasn't done way back in the 40s, folks. They're still doing this crap all over the place. I told you. Nazis were socialists, and socialists are Nazis. This suit is brought against the United States of America and other defendants, including DuPont, General Electric, Westinghouse, Rockwell International, the University of Washington, and Battelle Pacific Northwest Laboratory, for violations of the constitutional rights of the affected group of Native Americans under 42 United States Code, Section 1983, for infliction of radiological injuries, compensable under 42 U.S.C. Section 2210, the Price-Anderson Act, civil conspiracy, battery, strict liability, negligence, and other torts. These violations all arise out of the government's and other defendants' surreptitious and wrongful radiological experiments on the Native Americans. I've been doing it for a lot of years. I told you this a couple of years ago, that one of the tribes here in the Southwest called me up and told me about a mysterious sickness that their people were experiencing, and that the government doctors didn't help them and weren't helping them, and seemed to be just monitoring, you know, what was happening to them instead of helping them. And so we went over there and did an investigation, and, you know, all of the symptoms that they had were symptoms of radiation sickness. But we couldn't find any source of radiation until one day after we had returned to our base of operations. Somebody called us and said that they had found a dish in one of the streams that the Indians get their drinking water out of, with a rod, a metal rod, sticking out of the center of the dish and just barely protruded above the surface of the water, and in the dish were these little round pellets. So we packed up and went back over there again, and lo and behold, guess what those pellets did to a Geiger counter? The Geiger counter went absolutely berserk. They were putting these little dishes of radioactive pellets in their water supply, and these people were drinking the water and getting radiation sickness. And then the government doctors were monitoring the effects of the radiation on these people. Well, we showed them what was happening, and they cleaned up their streams and took that stuff. And I don't know what they did with it, but I got a sneaky feeling that well, I shouldn't say it because it's a suspicion. I don't really know what those Native Americans did with those radioactive pellets. But I got a sneaky feeling that they somehow put them where they would be affecting the government people and not them. But like I said, I don't really know. Nobody told me that. And I don't really know that that's what they did. So, but you see, they've been doing this stuff for many years. They've experimented on everybody, everywhere. In major American cities, in certain places, they have put biological warfare agents and people walking along that particular sidewalk or in that building where it was placed in the air conditioning system or in subways were infected. And then they monitored to see how far the infection would be spread and how intense it would become before it was detected by the medical authorities and properly treated. And they've done this with radiation also. And that's where Legionnaire's disease came from, ladies and gentlemen, whether you know it or not. Oh, you know, some of this stuff is just so horrible. I hesitate to even read it to you. Amazing. Let me see where this, I may not read this to you because the source isn't here. If it hasn't got a source, I don't like to do it. Won't do it, as a fact. Okay, here it is. Copyright. 1997, MediaFax Technologies Incorporated. MediaFax Technologies Incorporated put this out. And it's an article. It says, Friend Chai, which is Trigadlai, advises Fenton to withdraw United States warships while transferring China money to him. Hugo Gurdon reported today in the London Telegraph, this came from the London Telegraph, that the first detailed evidence linking covert contributions by Beijing to the Democratic Party in America emerged in a report that the Bank of China transferred money in batches of $50,000 and $100,000 to one of President Clinton's longtime Arkansas friends. The Wall Street Journal disclosed that Beijing's state-owned bank repeatedly wired cash in 1995 and 1996 to Charlie Tri, an ethnic Chinese-American whose Little Rock restaurant Mr. Clinton frequented during his days as state governor. Mr. Tri was a major fundraiser for the Democratic Party at the time the Bank of China was sending him the money. He says the funds he raised came from his and other supporters' business interests inside America, which would make them legal. But the Democrats have already returned $15,000 of dubious contributions to Mr. Tri, and he has left the country despite or because of being subpoenaed to give evidence to an expanding espionage investigation by the Justice Department. It is not clear whether the flow of money to Mr. Tri was from the Bank of China's own funds or from its other customers, most of whom are Asian businesses with operations in China. Ladies and gentlemen, considering the tremendous concessions that the Clinton administration has given to the communist Chinese in this country, including major seaports and including major seaports at both ends of the Panama Canal, what do you think it is? Huh? Come on now. What do you think it is? I told you a long time ago, long before this ever happened, that William Jefferson Clinton is a communist. Now listen to this. Remember the story that we gave you that every single day millions of dollars in $100 bills leave the airport in New York City for Moscow? Listen to this. Russian aid money stolen at London Airport. About $2.5 million of American aid destined for Russia has been stolen from London's Heathrow Airport, police said Sunday. The money was stolen from a high-security cargo compound while awaiting transfer from a New York flight to a plane bound for Moscow. The cash was in one of four bags containing a total of $10 million that were being transferred from a strong room for loading into a sealed container. Security officers raised the alarm after noticing the seals were broken. The money came from the Republic National Bank of New York. That's exactly the bank that I named on this broadcast of the origin of the money that the United States government was sending to Moscow every single day. Listen to this. The Washington Times. Officials scrambled last week to explain how thieves at London's Heathrow Airport were able to walk away with a canvas bag containing $2.5 million in cash bound from a New York bank to an institution in Moscow. The money, part of a $10 million commercial bank transfer from New York's Republic National Bank to Moscow's Toco Bank,
apparently was left unguarded for 30 minutes at an airport warehouse before being placed on a flight to the Russian capital on February 25th. Heathrow officials said the theft was obviously an inside job and that they have a couple of strong leads. Ha, ha, ha. U.S. government, get this, folks. U.S. government officials denied reports by the Associated Press, Reuters news agency, and the German news service Deutsche Press Agentur that the money was part of a U.S. foreign aid shipment to Russia. One of those reports was published March 2nd in the Washington Times. Listen to this. Quote, the United States does not provide cash aid to Russia, end quote. That's a barefaced lie. Remember also the memo that I read to you put out by the Treasury Department stating that they had sent Treasury agents to Moscow to reassure the Russian people that the new $100 bills were okay to use. Remember that? If you don't remember it, it's on tape. You can order the tape. Sunday, 5 April 1997, from the London Telegraph. New anthrax threatens Armageddon. Russia has developed a new variant of the anthrax toxin that is totally resistant to antibiotics and could cause a catastrophe, according to the defense publication Jane's. Jane's land-based air defense 1997-98 published on Thursday said the Russian military had developed the toxin and three new nerve agents. It gave warning of the dangers if the toxin fell into the wrong hands, saying, quote, an Armageddon situation could occur whereby the only reliable retribution may well be overwhelming nuclear response, end quote. The three nerve agents could be made without using any of the precursor chemicals that are banned under chemical weapons conventions. Two of the agents are reported to be eight times as deadly as the VX nerve agent that Iraq has acknowledged stockpiling, while the other is as toxic as VX nerve agent. Anthrax can cause festering boils, with its victims dying in agony unless treated quickly. What they don't tell you in Jane's is that the United States government has also developed anthrax as a biological warfare agent that is resistant to antibiotics. Ask the people at Dugway Proving Grounds. A good portion of that entire facility is off limits to human habitation because of experimentation with anthrax toxins and anthrax biological warfare agents, and no one, but no one, can walk into that area unprotected without catching anthrax and dying shortly thereafter. That's in the United States of America. Just thought I'd let you know. This is an excerpt from The Discovery of Freedom, Man's Struggle Against Authority, by Rose Wilder Lane, John Day Company, New York, 1943. Quote, all this intellectual world was far above the heads of most Americans. Educated men were reading Voltaire, Rousseau, Montesquieu, Chateaubriand, and along the Mississippi and the St. Lawrence, and in all the British possessions. But the uncultured tradesmen, farmers, sailors, hunters read practically nothing but almanacs, small town papers, and the Bible. They were children of men and women who had risked their lives to read the Bible. They knew of men burned at the stake, wrenched joint from joint on the rack, broken on the wheel, for saying that men had a right to read the Bible. They heard about the stealthy meetings in the dark, to hear the Bible read in a whisper by the light of one shaded candle, the alarm, the terror, the frantic escapes from the killers pursuing with torches through the alleys and over the rooftops, or the meetings on the open moors under moonless skies just to read the Bible, the sudden halloo and the charging horses and the running before the galloping hunters, the troopers riding down men and women, slashing them down with swords. Then the long hiding while the troopers searched craftily, and mothers that night, widowed, lay under water in the ditches, praying to God that the baby would not whimper and the hunt end before dawn. So, in America, they read the Bible. They were happy to be safe in America, where in open daylight and fearlessly, they could read the Bible. In Genesis, they read the nebular hypothesis of creation and the evolutionary theory of life's development on Earth. They read about adventures and crimes, hair's breadth escapes and wars and spies and business deals and political intrigues and stories of young lovers and of family life. They pondered the salty wisdom and the unsparing analysis of human motives and human nature. And when they read the words of Abraham and Moses and Gideon and Samuel and Christ saying that every individual is self-controlling and responsible, these words checked with the facts they knew from experience. So when British government tried to control them, they ignored it. To them, the king's mark on a tree was only a mark. If they needed the tree, they used it. When government stopped weaving in the colonies, weaving did not stop. Women went right on working at their looms. When the king controlled trade, he did not control it. The colonists went right on trading. The American Rebellion against England began in 1660, 39 years after the first pilgrim set foot on the stern, rock-bound coast, and until Cornwallis surrendered at Yorktown 121 years later, the American Rebellion was one continuous revolt against precisely authority pretending to control a planned economy. In 1660, while England was a piece of land entirely surrounded by smugglers and ghouls were digging up the dead to get wool and cloth, Charles II turned back his lace cuffs and signed another act to improve the industry of the realm. It provided that the American colonists could not ship wool, cotton, tobacco, sugar, and other articles desperately needed by the wretched English lower classes to any country but England. If a government were responsible for its subjects, this act would be as sensible as a farmer who, when his cattle are hungry, does not sell his corn but carries it only from the corn crib to the feeding trough. But human energy was working in America. The colonists were trading with the Spanish and French colonists. To stop this trade meant wretchedness in America. The Americans knew something about reality. They were fighting the sea and the earth for their lives, and a piece of parchment was not going to stop them. Overnight, this piece of parchment made them criminals, but they went right on trading with the West Indies, and the truth is that Charles II was too negligent to control trade. His ships sunk a few traders, ships, but not a single colonist was broken on the wheel or burned alive for the crime of trading wool for sugar. For 73 years, American business was partly smuggling. Running the blockades was an ordinary business hazard. The king's gunners killed a few sailors, wasted some goods, and kept prices higher than they would have been. That was all. The colonists, far from starving, prospered. Then in 1733, the government announced a 5-year plan. The French government was actually protecting French trade. The Sun King was reigning in France. That long, glorious reign was shining over Europe, an increasing brilliance that dazzled and civilized all Europeans who mattered, and lightened even the barbarian darkness of Muscovy. This was the 18th century, the age of enlightenment that dazzles Americans even yet. This was the century of French art and culture and intellectual leadership, the century of Versailles, which implanted in the minds of partisans or Parisians an imperishable belief in the imperishable glory of France. The French people kept no feudal liberties. They kept the feudal class structure and feudal duty. Ragged, hungry, starving, the French people, as loyal as sunflowers dying in a drought, still turned their faces up to their glorious and divine Sun King. French government absolutely did not permit its colonists to ship food to France to lower prices there and ruin merchants, so the French colonists had no markets. That is, there was overproduction in the West Indies. Desperately, their needy people would sell the products of their cane fields for anything they could get. So naturally, to protect its subjects from such ruinous competition, British government prohibited its American colonists buying cheap molasses and sugar and rum. But a great part of the colonists' business depended upon the West Indies trade. Cutting it off meant widespread ruin in the British colonies. The colonists uttered an awful howl, and in 1735, the British government soothingly replied, "This is only a 5-year plan. It may hurt a little now, but soon it will be over." A large number of businessmen in the colonies, therefore, were doing a little temporary smuggling. But in 1738, when the first Molasses Act expired, the British government renewed it, saying,
This is the second five-year plan. And smuggling now began to be very well organized. By 1743, repealing the Molasses Act would have caused a business crash in the colonies. But the government renewed it, saying, this is the third five-year plan. By this time, conditions in America were just what they became again when the federal government stopped drinking in this republic. Every jug of molasses, every lump of sugar, every rum toddy from Florida to Maine was illegal. A defiance of government. Anyone who dreamed of obeying the law was a crack-brained fanatic, and trying to enforce it was a farce. In and out of the ports and along the coast and across the Caribbean, the agile American ships showed their heels to His Majesty's Navy, or cornered, stood and fought. Cheered on by the folks back home, trade was thriving like anything. Traders were making fortunes. Every traveler to America marveled at the prosperity here. And in 1748, the reliable British government renewed the Molasses Act, repeating an explanation to which no one any longer listened.
A new five-year plan.
Then those two authorities that had to move their frontiers turned their guns on each other. The French and Indian Wars, the provincial colonists quaintly called that French War, because in America, both governments gave the Indians scalping knives and paid good prices for scalps and taught them how to scalp, for it was not an Indian activity. The cabins burned. The settlers were killed and scalped, or scalped and kept to be tortured and burned at the stake. The women were driven away to be Indian squaws and the children to be adopted Indians. You see, scalping was the first equivalent of the Vietnam body count. But the people must eat, trade must go on, and it did. Out of the war itself, the businessmen got a peaceful way of doing business, so long as the war with France lasted. Trade prospered between the English colonists and the French. And a trading ship's captain no longer ran from the Royal Navies, but stood too, waiting for the king's officers to come on board, and met them with a smile and a paper. For 6,000 years, under planned economies, a peaceful exchange of useful goods has survived by two means, smuggling and graft. In the true spirit of an old tradition, the colonial businessmen had produced a bright idea. Governments at war have prisoners to exchange. Why can't a trader exchange the prisoners? They bribed the French and British officers. They bribed the British and French port authorities. They got the prisoners and official permits to sail to the West Indies to exchange the prisoners. Then, so long as the war continued, the ship could sail back and forth carrying goods and the prisoners. Lively business and permits and prisoners developed in every port. The permits were sold at public auction. Prices went up and down, and speculators played the permit market. Of course, nothing but force could have separated the prisoners from the permits. Idle and well-fed, the captives, both French and English, went right along with those papers and rode out the war in endless sea voyages. The Americans, ladies and gentlemen, are an inventive, intelligent people who will not be enslaved, just as they got by then, just as they developed prohibited markets then, just as they maintained their freedom and carried on their trade when it was prohibited then. We will do so in the future. Good night, and God bless you all. Americans cannot and will not be enslaved. We will fight and die before we would ever allow any such thing to even come close to happening. God help those who would, in their wildest dreams, even pretend to conceive a plan whereby they could bring that about.
for our retribution will be swift and terrible, I can assure you. This is the Voice of Freedom. Listening to the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network, broadcasting on satellite GE1, transponder 7, 7.56 audio, and over 700 FM stations across the nation and around the world.
This is my daddy's station. I'm Pooh, classic radio like you always wished it could be, 101.1 FM, eager.
101.1 FM is owned and operated by the Independence Foundation Trust as a non-profit community service.
We return you now to our regularly scheduled programming, All Oldies Most of the Time. And that great racket you hear in the background, ladies and gentlemen, is the wind just wreaking havoc up here.
Well, I went and lost her to the great imposter.